coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to today's Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, and David Weber. Today we will look at the lessons for the fifth Sunday of Easter, the season we're now in, and the readings are from Acts 8, verses 26 through 40. The psalm for this day is 150. The epistle lesson is from 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 through 11, and the gospel reading is from John chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. And here's David Weber. Welcome back.
Thanks, Jamie. The passage revolves around Jesus calling himself the true vine. And unpacking that requires that we go back to the beginning of Jesus' first miracle in changing the water into wine. Now, we preface that Jesus makes it clear that he came into the world to save the world and not to condemn the world. Jesus doesn't reject the natural world. He rather offers the supernatural solution to the natural world and brings the natural world to its rightful end. And we know that Jesus inaugurated this mission, which what I think is a joyful and saturated gesture of changing water into wine. Now, we know that water is routinely changed into wine as the rainwater is absorbed by the grapevines, producing ripened grapes. They are then crushed and casked, and then the grapes are elevated by fermentation rather than ruined by decay. So it's little wonder that wine is associated with the Jewish toast, L'chaim, which means to life. You hold up a glass of wine and you wish that your own life would follow the natural history of wine itself, moving from water to the grape. And then when it is crushed and dies, it does not decay. It is fermenting. It gets better. It's elevated. This is what the toast to life means, and this is an image of the life that Jesus came to give. So when Jesus identified himself as the vine, he is letting us know that he is the vine that was missing at the wedding. He is the vine that turns water into wine. And he intends to give this life to the world. Now, John includes that one of the aspects of this gift of life that we receive is the promise that God will prune everything in our lives that hinders us from being fruitful. Now, we oftentimes focus on the pain, which seems unpromising, but yet, Jesus makes it clear in the hands of the heavenly vine dresser, even our pains become cathartic. They are a cutting away of anything that would destroy the fulfillment that we desire in having a fruitful life that doesn't come to an end. So when Jesus makes this connection of being the true vine, it is a beautiful and brilliant way to think about what it is, what life that he gives to us, and why that new life in Christ is so promising and filled with the possibilities of joy and enjoyment. Now, obviously, the Psalms are there to tell us more about this life of praise or this life of joy. In fact, the book of Psalms claims the title Psalm, which is praise, by concluding a collection of six Psalms at the end of this book, and they're Psalms of praise. Now, the claim that this book of Psalms is about praise flies in the face of the fact that most of the Psalms, about two-thirds of the content, are actually filled with complaints about God's absence, complaints about suffering, injustice, complaints about enemies who promote error and evil. In the ancient Greek theater, a tragedy begins well and ends badly, and a comedy begins badly and ends well. So the psalm recognizes or takes on a comedic tilt when it kind of expresses in these last six psalms the truth of Shakespeare's title of Shakespeare's comedy, All's Well That Ends Well. So in other words, not everything is going well in as life unfolds. In fact, as the psalms make it clear, things are going badly, but it's the ending of the thing. As Ecclesiastes says, better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the result of that is that it's better to be patient in spirit rather than proud in spirit. So the Psalms teach us to expect that the life in the life-giving vine will be fruitful. It doesn't mean that everything is going to be without pain. And when this life comes to fruition, comes to bear fruit, it will end in spontaneous and expressive praises of shouts, music, and dancing. But that's to come. Right now, we live in the meantime, and the meantime can be very mean, as the Psalms teach us how to complain and teach us how to pray to God in the midst of injustice, and teach us how to hope when things are hopeless. And it teaches us how to understand that our life lived in Christ the vine is moving towards a comedic conclusion. So in the meantime, we still praise, but our praise is much less spontaneous than it will be, and so it has to be more scheduled and scripted. As we make our way through life's unfruitful elements with laments and complaints, all the while anticipating that as time unfolds, our satisfaction and our desires will eventually be fulfilled in the fruitful life that we so desire now, and which the Psalms teach us to continually keep our eyes on and to pray for. This is the life of praise. Now in Acts, we get a historical recording of what it was like for the first Christians to come into this knowledge that Christ has changed the conditions of our world, and that that change changes the way that we live. It is not absolutely clear how it changes the way we live, and so the book of Acts is a very long and involved book about the various ways that Christian started thinking about this new life. One of the incidences is with this eunuch, this Ethiopian eunuch. I have to say that the eunuch personifies the cruelty of the ancient world. But the eunuch also points us to the attractiveness of this new life in Christ. Let me try to explain this. In his confessions, Augustine, who at this point is not yet a Christian, thought that the Christian Bishop Ambrose was a ridiculous character. He had access to all sorts of money and to other people, and yet he practiced celibacy and charity. Why would you have access to unlimited sex and money and yet refuse to access this, refuse to use it and use others, and rather practice celibacy and charity? Well, humorously, I think, then Augustine started thinking about his mother Monica, and he was baffled why she so completely trusted Ambrose. And then it dawns on him This is because Ambrose was motivated by neither passion nor purse. He was a man who was in love with learning and the learning that turned to loving. And this is why Monica finally was able to trust this bishop. The Ethiopian was mutilated as a young man because the ancient world thought that he would be more trustworthy, and you needed to be trustworthy if you were going to be in charge of the queen's money. Somehow, we don't know how, he's drawn to Jerusalem to worship in the temple, and he's drawn to Isaiah's image of Christ's life-giving sacrifice. And he desires then to understand who this person who suffered such a devastating humiliation is, and how is it that when he was denied justice and his life was taken away, yet these were not things that deprived the world of life, but his humiliation and injustice actually gave life to the world. The eunuch wondered, how did this victim's speechless humiliation result in new life to the world? It's not hard to imagine, having suffered such cruel injustice, why the eunuch so desired Philip to explain to him how the salvation of Jesus could come out of the crucifixion and humiliation, and how the resurrection had changed even the most humiliating aspects of our lives. So this takes us then to John, which I think beautifully explains more clearly what it is that the eunuch saw in the Isaiah passage and what he wanted to understand. John says that we have in fact overcome the world. At the heart and center of this text is this assertion that Christ is the life-giving vine. Antichrist is the life-taking parasite. And Antichrist has already been defeated by Jesus' resurrection, but yet he still wreaks chaos on the world, but he lives on borrowed time. He's still capable of killing the body, but he cannot kill the vine that has brought life into the world. And we, being connected to the vine, have already overcome the spirit of Antichrist in this world. Already, John is not hesitant to say that the victory has already been won because Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. So now we experience and enjoy our life in Christ, John says, by doing two things. First of all, by overcoming the world, we overcome the world by cultivating a critical examining approach to the world. This is because, ironically, you cannot trust anyone unless you are confident that you have the capacity to sniff out posers who are false prophets. Living the life of trust is not being naive or easily persuaded. No, John says, living the life of trust requires that your life be an examining life. It's a life of learning. Now, why is it a life of learning? Not in order to exercise power or pride over other people. Rather, the examining life desires to know the world and others and God truthfully. Because if you are confident you know the truth, then you can love trustingly. And that is the love which overcomes the ruining spirit of Antichrist. So, four passages, loosely connected, but how one puts them together is still a bit baffling to me. But while I'm not preaching this Sunday, the idea of once again connecting, seeing Jesus as the true vine and what that imagery means within ancient Judaism and has unfolded over time would be a really delightful exercise. Trying, but delightful in the end, I think.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, go to the App Store or Google Play, and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.